your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
A semi-regular feature on this show is, what's it really like to be a kind of a modern version of Studs Terkel? And I've interviewed everyone from a psychiatrist to a sex worker. But today's version, or today's episode, if you will, may be the most unusual. What's it really like to be a sumo wrestler? And I was fortunate to get a very special sumo wrestler. Bianjavav Ulambayar holds 4 world sumo champion titles. And in his 12 years at the U.S. Sumo Open, he has won the gold medal 10 out of 12 years, and the other two, a mere silver. He spent his childhood in Mongolia, most of his time, his last 12 years in the U.S. Biamba, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hey there, Marty. We just got the call dropped. This is Andrew. I'm going to get Biamba right back on.
Okay. So I will, while we're waiting for the call to come, him to come back on, I'm going to introduce Andrew. Andrew, I'll tell you, is also kind of an interesting story. He is the producer of and announcer at the U.S. Sumo Open. And lest you think he's just a talker, Andrew Freund is a multi-time U.S. national sumo champion, beating much heavier wrestlers. Guess how much he weighs? 150 pounds. So, Andrew, are you back yet? I guess not. So I'm going to temporize, give you hopefully some heads up about what's going to happen. I guess I'll tell you what I'm going to do in segment 2. Hopefully we will indeed get Andrew and Biamba on the air, because I was curious. I am curious to know what it's really like to be a sumo wrestler. I think you may find it interesting, too. Do we have them back?
I'm here. I'm going to try Biamba one more time. It was working fine before. We'll try it again.
And if not, we'll just do Biamba, I think, because if we have to have one, we should be having... Am I right that we should be having him, or should we have you?
We'll work it out here. I'm calling him right now.
All right. You see, this is live radio. You know, we rehearsed this. We went through this. We had the whole thing logistically prepared. And then there we go. So let me tell you what we're going to do in segment 2 after we talk about sumo wrestling, whether it be with Andrew or Biamba.
We are on with you now, Marty.
Are you both here? Biamba, are you around?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, good. So let's start. I mean, I'm always interested in what might surprise me about being a sumo wrestler. Biamba?
Yes.
What might surprise me about being a sumo wrestler?
About how powerful is it, I think. Kind of, you know, the human body, how strong is it, you know? That's the most important thing.
Now, we always think about, you know, sumo wrestlers as being very fat. That's how they're characterized. I did do so in preparation for the show. I did watch the U.S. Open sumo champion, and there are people who are very skinny, like Andrew at 150 pounds, and there's a whole lightweight division of people who are, and then there are people who are heavy as 600 pounds. Give me a sense of how strong. Can you give me an idea of, you know, your they tend to be, I mean, is it insulting to say that sumo wrestlers in the heavyweight division are fat? How do you feel when I say that to you?
あの、もう、さ、sumo さんがファットと言ったらどういう気持ちですか？なんか本当にみんなファットじゃないでしょ？
Okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make an executive decision here on my own. Andrew, I'm going to conduct this interview with you. Is that all right, Biamba?
Sure. I tell you what, Biamba can add a few things, but let me tell you this, Marty.
Yeah.
When Biamba was in pro sumo at 350 pounds, they did a body fat test, and he was about 11% body fat.
Wow. Okay. How strong? So give me a sense of how strong. What does that mean? For us, you know, who have nothing, no knowledge about sumo, can you compare it to some other kind of strength? I mean, can you tell me something about what that strength Biamba is referring to is?
Well, I think you would be shocked. And Biamba just mentioned people are surprised about how powerful sumo wrestlers are. First of all, the amount of endurance that they have is ridiculous. You know, most people here do a one-hour workout at a gym, and they can't move. When Biamba was in pro sumo, he'd wake up at dawn, he'd train for 5 hours
Wow.
straight, That is continuous training for 5 hours, and he'd, you know, lose 10 or 15 pounds of sweat all morning training, yeah.
Well, what surprises me is, you know, I had never really watched sumo before, but in watching the U.S. Open, the average match takes like 30 seconds. So how much, you just need massive strength, not endurance, right?
Well, you need all of the above. And I'll tell you one more thing, Marty. We're very proud of producing the U.S. Sumo Open. The 19th annual is in March 23rd in a couple months in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. Sumo Open is the biggest tournament in the Western Hemisphere, but it doesn't compare with pro sumo in Japan, where Byamba competed for about 5 years. And he would train every day of the year with only a few days off, every single morning for hours on end. And he was exceptional because he would also do additional afternoon training while everyone else was resting. So he was an incredible example of just amazing fitness. So endurance is one thing. Strength is another. Byamba's known for lifting weights, and he's very, very powerful.
What I'm not understanding is that if the average match takes 30 seconds or a minute, I could see where strength matters, because all you're really doing in sumo is trying to either tackle the guy or push him out of the circle. Why would endurance matter if the average, you know, the average match takes 30 seconds or a minute?
Well, there's one way for you to find out, Marty. You should step into the ring.
No, thank you.
If you exert yourself in a sumo match for maybe 10 or 15 seconds, and you haven't done many sports lately, you probably collapse, because you're going 100% energy. And people do 10-second matches, and they can barely breathe afterwards.
Wow.
It's that intense. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So, go ahead. Please continue. Please.
So, yeah, strength and endurance are very important, but probably the biggest surprise for most people, because they think sumo wrestlers are just obese, but really they're great athletes, the biggest surprise, if you go to Japan and watch them train, the most incredible feats are what they do with flexibility and speed. You don't think of a 300, 400, 500-pounder as fast or agile or flexible, but they spend the first hour of training every morning doing those leg lifts where they put the leg up to shoulder height.
Wow.
Slowly, and then kind of, you know, take it down and then stomp on the ground. So they do maybe 500 of those leg lifts in a row. Yeah, it takes an hour. So that you know, most people here, they try to do that leg lift. They can't even do it correctly.
Of course
but
not.
Even doing it incorrectly, you know, they could probably only do 5 or 6 of those lifts, and they're tired. The guys in Japan are doing it 500 times in a row.
Byamba, do you hate all those practices, or do you like all those practices?
Well, of course, when you start wrestling first time, it was so hard, and I was thinking, oh, why do I have to do this? You know.
Yeah, and now at many, you're in your middle 30s. Do you still train? How much time do you spend practicing and training now?
Well, it used to be when I was a professional, I did it every morning, but now it's like 3-4 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I just go to the gym and, you know, doing some warm-ups and kind of my techniques, you know.
Is it hard to motivate yourself to do all that very, very arduous, that very hard work?
どうやってそのやる気できる、なんかもっとビャンボはそういうスポーツが好きとか?
Well, you know, all my life is just wrestling. So, you know, basically I love this sport. That's why I'm still keep doing that.
Okay, Andrew, does Byamba, you know, he's a four-time world champion. Does he still have a coach? And if so, what does a coach work on with him at this stage?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in Japan, there's always a direct relationship with the coach. But once Byamba left pro sumo, he's kind of been a pioneer in terms of being like an ambassador of sumo all over the world. And everywhere he goes, he's taught sumo to others, but there's no one who really knows more than he does, hardly at all, outside of Japan. So he's really kind of had to coach himself as well as others. He's probably picked up a few tips from some of the other former Japanese pros that we've brought here, but, you know, he's always developing himself, not only in sumo, but like we mentioned, in terms of weight training and cardio and other exercises. So I think he just has to keep himself motivated, and he knows what he's doing, that's for sure.
Byamba, are you learning any new techniques or practicing your old ones?
Well, I mean, of course I'm practicing my old ones, but, you know, in this age, I couldn't change my sumo style, I think.
Okay. And you're about 34 or 35 years old. How and you're now mainly doing exhibitions, and you were all, I saw you in the 2018 U.S. Open, and you came in second in the heavyweight division. How long do you continue? Do you think you're going to continue doing sumo wrestling? You weigh 350 pounds.
Well, I didn't decide to retire yet, but you know, like I said, I love in this sport. So if my health condition, everything is perfect, I want to still do that, you know?
Okay. Do you have to do anything? Do you have to either eat more or eat less? First of all, is 350 pounds the weight you really like to be for doing sumo wrestling?
Well, I lost a little weight right now, about 340 right now, but, you know, if you doing training a lot, you have to take a protein. So it doesn't mean like you have to eat a lot, you know.
Do you worry about being the health effects of being heavy?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah, Marty, I'll add that Byamba is incredibly athletic at his weight. So he's pretty much all muscle. And he's very agile, so he plays basketball, he plays golf, you know, he can ride a bike. We actually, on one show, we brought him surfing, and with his first lesson, he was surfing on a board. So he's a natural athlete, and it's not like if you see him on the street in a T-shirt, he doesn't look, quote-unquote, fat or obese at all. He looks very muscular, like a football lineman, basically.
What I'd like to do is give our listeners a chance to ask a question or two. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. Those of you who are regular listeners to the show know I do a semi-regular feature called What's It Really Like to Be A? And kind of a modern version of Studs Terkel. But I must admit that this is probably the most unusual example. I mean, I've done doctors and lawyers and wait staff and everything under the sun. But I, you know, sumo wrestler? I'm speaking with Byamba Jav Ulambayar, who likes to call himself Byamba. He holds four world sumo champion titles. And I'm also talking with the producer of and the announcer at the U.S. Sumo Open, Andrew Freund. If you have a question for either Andrew or Byamba, this is the time to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Byamba, you said that you're not ready to stop wrestling at this point. When you do stop, what do you think you're going to be doing with your time? You're not going to be working out hours a day. You're not going to be traveling to do all these exhibitions. What do you think you're going to do with your time, Byamba?
For now?
After you decide to retire from sumo wrestling.
Probably enjoy my baby. Watching my baby.
You have a child. Would you want your child, if your child said he wanted to do sumo seriously and become a professional sumo wrestler, what would you say to him?
Of course, I'm going to, if he wants himself, I'm going to send him to Japan.
Okay. And what's the one piece of advice you would give him in order to both enjoy and be successful in sumo?
Well, you know, probably before the practice, he has to do warm-up at least 1 hour and 2 hours.
Wow.
That way, he cannot have injury or, you know. So that means he can keep doing some wrestling a long time.
We have calls online. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What is your question or comment for Byamba or the head of the U.S. Sumo Open, Andrew Freund? Hi, it's you. You're on the air. Are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. I hear you pretty well.
Awesome. Thank you. So, I have two questions. One is, obviously, I would say about 50% of what the gentleman does is purely mental.
Right.
So do you practice any meditation or calming or some meditative techniques to prepare you and to and to focus?
Good question. Biyombo, do you meditate or do any mental preparation?
Well, not really.
Okay. Well, you said you had two questions, caller. What's your second question?
The second part is, what's your typical diet like? You know, what's your calorie intake, and how do you manage that?
Okay. What is your tip? What do you typically eat during the? What is a typical day's eating for Biyombo?
Andrew, you can answer.
Well, yeah, I'll help with that, Marty. Thank you. That's a good question, caller. So, Biyombo, when he was in Pro Sumo in Japan, they normally train all morning and have their first meal for lunch, so they have a big lunch and a big dinner, and the food is normally chonkonabe, which is a stew. It's all fresh vegetables and meat and bowls of rice. So it's a really nutritious diet, stew and rice, but they pack on a huge amount of weight by consuming bowl after bowl of it. And if you want to see, there's a perfect 10-minute documentary about Biyombo and his diet. Vice Foods has a great 10-minute piece. Just go to Vice Foods and type in sumo, and you'll see 10-minute video about Biyombo.
Great. Caller, thank you very much. Andrew, I want to give you the last word. What is one thing you haven't yet, you or Biyombo, hasn't told our listeners about what it's really like to be a professional sumo wrestler that you think would interest my listeners? What would that be, Andrew?
Well, there's so much I could go into, Marty, but very briefly, and I'm not speaking from experience because I didn't compete in Japan in the pros, but I'll say one thing that probably stands out a lot. When Americans learn about what pro sumo is like in Japan, they're shocked because it's not like pro sports here where there's a season and an off season. When Biyombo joined the pros, he spent about 5 years there, and he only got to see his family once during that time because it's like the military. You live, breathe, train, eat, sleep all together with your team all year long. It's nonstop training. So it's an incredible lifestyle, and because of that learning Biyombo had in pro sumo, that's what made him so good and why he has been the most dominant international sumo wrestler for the last 12 years, you know, with the 4 world champion titles. And I'll say this, last thing, you can see Biyombo and many other top guys compete at the U.S. Sumo Open March 23rd in L.A., and to find out more, usasumo.com. And in case you folks up in Northern California can't make it on March 23rd, we do a lot of events up in San Francisco, including at the Japan Center Malls every fall, and we do a lot of corporate events in Silicon Valley. So if you want to meet Biyombo Yama, come to our site, send an email. We'll give you more info about great events up in the Bay Area.
I will want to thank you then, Andrew Freund and Biyombo Jav Ulaanbaatar. Thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Our pleasure, Marty.
Take care, guys. Okay, from sumo wrestling to the more likely to be your career issue, I do like to share under-the-radar careers because everybody knows about the obvious, and what I try to do is add value here. So, and it's, you know, whether you're looking for a new career or a job or not, it's kind of fun to hear about the not obvious. But I first want to give out the phone number in case you have a work-related problem. Maybe mission one here on the show, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, is helping you with your work life. If you've got any kind of work-related problem or a story that you'd like to share that's either interesting or might even be instructive related to your work life, this is the time to call when the lines are available. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for what I call a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And so now, as promised, while waiting for the calls to come in, I want to share some of these under-the-radar careers. I really think that epidemia, you know, we all hear about healthcare is growing, how we hear doctors and nurses and, respiratory therapists, but most people don't think about being an epidemiologist. But with the world ever smaller, diseases spread fast. And we're seeing, a lot of, more open borders. And with bioterrorism also an increasing risk, those diseases that are fast spreading are not just natural, but they can be, unfortunately, man-made. I was watching C-SPAN today, and they were talking about their big fears about bioterrorism. Well, epidemiologists, a very under-the-radar kind of a science career, medical career, they track, usually not all of them, but many of them, track and predict an outbreak spread. And, of course, they develop plans for its mitigation. Think about the Ebola, when the Ebola scare occurred. Or very often there's tainted lettuce. You know, an epidemiologist is going to deal with how you go, with the outbreak of the lead at the E. coli in lettuce, where they find that perhaps the workers may have been peeing on the lettuce, maybe because there wasn't a porta potty near enough by or whatever. But that can spread, you know, very rapidly, and epidemiologists help figure out how to find out where it started and mitigate it. And also, epidemiologists, and this is less well known. Again, I like to talk about the less well known, but still interesting. Often epidemiologists use a combination of the hard science but also social science methods to help governments develop plans and policies to help prevent conditions that would lead to an epidemic. Just even things like obesity. We keep hearing how in recent decades we've heard the term obesity and epidemic used hand in hand. Of course, back in the 80s, not that AIDS is at all cured or even fully controlled, but we called it an AIDS epidemic in previous decades, and certainly epidemiologists were core to helping the governments and nonprofits develop plans and policies, and also companies, you know, were very involved in trying to stem the AIDS spread. And so it's a very interesting under-the-radar health career. And there is a website that would give you more information on this call that's publichealthonline.org/epidemiology. I have a number of other of these under-the-radar careers, which I will share with you, but I'd like to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem or a story you'd like to tell, maybe this week something really good or really bad or simply really interesting happened to you at work, or maybe you've even you've got a small business that is not doing so well, or it's doing well and you want to take it to the next level, or an idea that you're wondering whether it's something you should quit your day job to become an entrepreneur, a self-employed person. All those are good reasons to call for what I call a work over here at Work with Marty Nemco. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now I want to talk about the under-the-radar career of surveyor. Exactly where should each square foot of that new light rail system go? Or where should the fence between homeowners be located? Or where is that oil spill moving? How does a cartographer, that's a map maker, obtain the information needed to create an underwater map? By the way, do you know that only 5% of oceans have been mapped, so there certainly is demand? Who are the people who answer those questions? Surveyors. They may still use the old-fashioned theodolites. Theodolites are the fancy word for those little cameras on tripods. But now, more often, they're using satellite-based GIS systems, geographic information systems, and remote sensors. And surveying is really a career for somebody who doesn't have or want a college degree, but who is comfortable around algebra and geometry, and who would rather learn as an apprentice and would like an outdoor career with some status. I had the privilege of having a conversation with California's director of its state apprenticeship programs, and he told me that of the hundreds of apprenticeable careers, he considers overall net-net surveying the best. If you want to learn more about surveying, there is a website called Be a Surveyor. And surveyor is spelled, by the way, with an O-R at the end. Be a surveyor, BEASURVEYOR.com. Next career I want to talk about, so under the radar, again, another healthcare career. We all know that we've heard ad nauseum about how the aging boomers and, frankly, the high-need, low-pay, large immigrant population has a lot of healthcare needs, and we all know, therefore, that healthcare is going to healthcare jobs will be expanded. They certainly can't be offshored. But again, I like to share that which is not obvious. And one of the less obvious ones is something called an electroneurodiagnostic technician. They used to call them EEG, electroencephalogram technicians, but now it's broader, so they call them electroneurodiagnostic technician. What do they do? They monitor your brain waves. Why would you want to do that? Well, if you are a patient in surgery, the brain waves indicate how well the anesthesia is working. Or if you've got sleep problems, you have to go to another sleep clinic like there's one at Stanford. Brain waves help figure out what's causing a person's insomnia. And doctors may use EEGs, again, these are electroencephalograms, to determine how well a medication is helping somebody with epilepsy. But, you know, this sounds hard and important, but, and this is music to so many of my listeners and my clients' ears, training is short, maybe at a community college or even on the job. And the employment prospects are good. You want to learn more about that? There is a website, and it's called, this is a really obnoxiously long, but it's explorehealthcareers.org/career/allied-health-professions/neurodiagnostic-technologist. By the way, if any of you want these, and I don't expect you to be racing over to your pen or your computer to write these down, so I'm always happy to answer emails from you, my dear listeners. So if you'd like any of these websites, you can email me. My email address is mnemko, that's M as in Mary, M as in Marty, you know, and then my last name, Nemko, N-E-M-K-O, mnemko@comcast.net. Okay, more careers that are under the radar. Oh, by the way, I want to, before I forget, really under the radar, you know, people get grossed out at the thought of working at a wastewater treatment plant. And yet, that's where there really is job, so much so that they're having job fairs. And I just heard about one from my colleague, Maureen Nelson, who works at the Contra Costa, some kind of employment development entity. But anyway, there's this organization that recruits people for the wastewater industry called Baywork, and there is a career, what they're calling a career exploration event, where they are demoing the various careers related to wastewater treatment, machinists, electrical workers, wastewater treatment operators, and there are also engineering jobs. It is going to be, let me get it right, it is February 27th, so you've got almost a whole month to prepare. February 27th, there are two separate ones. There is one specifically for students from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Laney College, and from 2 to 5, there is one that is open to the general public. So they call it Water Industry Careers Career Exploration Event, and I thought I would share that with you. Again, the phone number if you need a workover, you got some work-related problem, the phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I think to prime the pump, the first person to call will get a free autographed copy of my book, Careers for Dummies. So if my free advice is not enough to incent you, you'll get a free copy of my new book, Careers for Dummies. 415-841-4134. The next under-the-radar career, I want to stay with healthcare just one more time here. An under-the-radar healthcare career is called heart-lung perfusionist. In open-heart surgery, the surgeon can't work on the heart if blood is squirting all over the place. So a machine is hooked up to an artery to receive the blood. The machine then, like a heart and lungs, pumps blood and air back into an artery on the other side of the heart and lungs, and therefore the circulation can continue. Meanwhile, the heart is relatively bloodless, so the surgeon can work. The surgeon then hooks up the blood vessels, and the perfusionist runs the machine. It sounds straightforward, but if you talk to any perfusionist, and he or she will say that the job is stressful. One mistake can be one too many for a patient. Only calm people with a high tolerance for stress do well. Perfusion is the smallest of all the healthcare professions, with only 4,000 practitioners in the entire state. Entire country. And because of the aging population, more likely to need heart surgery, there is a shortage. Again, there is a good website for additional information about that career. And again, it's got that obnoxiously long URL, explorehealthcareers.org/career/allied-health-professions/perfusionist. I guess, all right, one more healthcare career. A prosthetist or orthotist. Picture this. You're sitting there. An amputee walks into your office. Your job is to make his or her artificial limb or brace. The limbs are the prosthetist, the braces are the orthotist. You've got to be able to work face-to-face with amputees and create limbs and braces with precision. After all, you're preparing a device on which that person's ability to use hands or feet really depends. You need extensive training, but a lot of the schools are public, so it doesn't cost, and pardon the pun here, an arm and a leg. Anyway, there is a website I've dug up that on that career, on orthotic and prosthetics careers, that is a lot shorter than the ones I just gave you, and it's simply opcareers.org, O-P and the word careers.org. Now we finally leave the healthcare space, and again, under the radar. Polygraph examiner, commonly known as the lie detector operator. Well, are you a calm and analytic and detail-oriented person who would enjoy figuring out whether people are telling the truth? That is what polygraph examiners attempt to do. They hook you up to a machine that monitors various physiological functions, and if things start spiking when you ask, did you murder your spouse, you may be a step closer to life imprisonment. In any case, most polygraphers work for, polygraphers, I guess they'd be called. They work for law enforcement agencies, of course. But polygraph tests are also used in pre-employment testing, at least in sensitive fields like daycare, and by attorneys who are trying to prove that the clients are upstanding citizens. Anyway, there is a website I've got for you for that. It's also annoyingly long. It's www.thebalance.com/polygraph-examiner-career-profile-974652. This isn't bad radio. I don't know what is, but I wanted to take those 10 seconds for each of these careers to give you a lead on something. Okay. Another career that, again, very under the radar, farrier. I'll bet you don't even know what a farrier is. I had not heard of it until a few years ago. It's the person who puts horseshoes on horses. Do you know that horses' hooves grow like our nails do? And when they're overgrown, a farrier is the person who's got to trim them and reshoe the horse. There's a saying that's no hoof, no horse. The pay is good. Maybe that's because very few farriers can do it after age 45. It's quite physical. There's another saying in this field that says that every farrier has only so many shoeings in him. Other downsides, you've got to be really careful to ensure you don't cripple the horse and that it doesn't cripple you. Horses are known to kick in the course of the horseshoeing process, especially if you don't do it right. But if you love the idea of doing physically demanding work with horses and you're good with your hands and you don't mind having to face a career change in your 40s, that's not for the faint of heart, a career in horseshoeing can be lucky. Anyway, a website about farrier. This is an interview. I've got a website that's got a great interview with a farrier, and it's www.jobshadow.com/an-interview-with-a-farrier. Give out the phone number again. If you've got a work-related problem, like my advice, I've been doing it for 29-plus years on this show. Happy to do this. Is my pro bono work. I'm happy to try to help you with your work-related problem. I usually can. The phone number, 415-841-4134. What's that the number for? A work over here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW. 415-841-4134. I've had many clients who would love a career in the arts. They love fashion, they love design, they love color, all the rest of it. And so they think about being a fashion designer. But again, with my desire to keep things under the radar, there is a niche within clothing design that is very less often thought of, and that is accessory design. Designs for shoes, handbags, they change almost as often as for clothing, and yet many aspiring clothing designers don't consider designing accessories, so it isn't quite as crowded a field. And even less crowded might be accessories for men. And still less crowded is creating what I call a mass customized accessory. There is a real move now to creating mass customization, individualized, like building your own handbag kind of thing. Okay, next. This is a career that I never understood. It's been around. I've been touting it for decades, but it's never really took off, and I don't understand why. I still think it's a good idea. Dating coach. A dating coach could do one or more or all of these. They could help the client help the client get clear on what sort of relationship he or she wants, whether it be adventurous or stable, or just hook up, or marriage. Dating coach, in light of, let's say you've gotten your client clear on what they want, and in light of that client's personality, what combination of activities should be in the plan? What kind of dating websites should they get set up with friends? Should friends set them up? Should they take a class? Should they teach a class? Sometimes teaching a class, because there's an authority thing there that you accrue, can be a great thing. Can you teach a dance class, teach a finance class, or take one? Would your Mr. or Ms. Wright be in that class? Should you travel with or without a wing person? And the dating coach could, you know, put the strategy and the action plan in writing. A dating coach could help the client create an online dating profile that reflects who that person really is, not the BS kind of dating profiles that are out there, and accurately, you know, helps that client tease out what the person is really looking for. It may also include taking pictures for the profile. So often, you know, especially in the romantic world, pictures can be as important as text or more. And somebody who's a pro at creating dating pictures might be better at it than your, you know, generic photographer. Okay, so now I'm still in dating coach things dating coaches could do. So this is just a marketing thought, I guess. Let's say the dating coach has created an impressive portfolio of the profiles that he or she has helped clients create. That dating coach could try to get hired as a dating website's in-house profile writer, eliminating the need for you to do marketing because you got all these clients coming directly from the dating website. Other things a dating coach could do: could help decide which profiles the person, your client, should reach out to and respond to. Help, of course, not do it. The dating coach could role play flirting, could role play dates. And not only can that provide useful feedback and tips, clients that are shy or socially anxious will benefit from the desensitizing effect of doing these role played dates. And you could video them. After all, you know, video is core to any kind of instruction, from golf to interviewing, right? So why not dating? A dating coach could help in, could go shopping, helping the client select clothes, hairstyles, makeup. Either just talking at their home, visiting their closet, or even accompanying them on a shopping trip. A dating coach could double date with the client and then afterwards provide feedback. Dating coach could meet regularly to discuss the progress and, if needed, make changes. Dating coach could coach the client on how to turn a good first date into a blossoming relationship. And, you know, dating coach could even offer group activities like a long-term relationship boot camp. And you could have that be highlighted again with video, like a video recorded mock mini dates on which each person would get and give feedback. And, of course, the boot camp's leaders would also give feedback. Anyway, I think it's a fabulous coaching career that we all know about: career coaches and life coaches, but financial coaches. But dating coach seems like, look how much I was, how many different niches within dating coach, how many different ways in which a dating coach could be of benefit there are. So I've got a website, but I think I just Google how to become a dating coach. There's a great website that's on a site called coachestrainingblog.com that should help you with that. I've got a couple more coaching careers, but I want to give out the phone number again. Would you like some help with your work life or someone you care about, your son, your daughter, granddaughter, parent, any kind of work-related problem, for-profit, non-profit, whether you're 16 or 76, or you have a story you want to tell, or a self-employment idea you want to run by me? The phone number here at Work with Marty and M. Cohen, KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I promised a couple of more coaching options. Another less obvious kind of coaching is parenting coaching. Whether a parent has a newborn or an adult child who's, you know, one of those who's just moved back home, many parents worry that they're not good enough parents. They don't want a therapist. They just want to help in getting a little pride and joy to not drive them crazy. Of course, parents who've got a special needs kid or one who's got a substance abuse problem may particularly call on you. Parenting coaches could market to individual parents, like maybe they would offer free seminars at a PTA meeting or at a public library. Or the parenting coach could try to get referrals, say, from their child's pediatrician. Another good niche, there's Google Becoming a Parenting Coach. There's a really good article about that. And the only other, for today at least, the only other coaching niche I want to talk about is retirement coach. Boomers are now reaching retirement age, and many of them with a fair degree of trepidation. They may need to plan on living another 30 years, but they've saved only for a fraction of that. Work may be central to their identity, and even with a bit of part-time work and volunteering to fill the gap, they're going to worry they're going to feel out to pasture. And couples that are in retirement suddenly find themselves spending more time together, and that may not be so much fun. Enter the retirement coach, who may assist in financial planning, helping the client figure out how to fill days, or readjust to seeing that spouse more often. And there is an association of retirement coaches. Just Google. Here is the URL. It's retirementcoachesassociation.org. And those are the under-the-radar careers that I wanted to share with you. Now what I think I'd like to do is I've got a bunch of tweets. These are various topics. Those of you who listen to the show regularly know that, every so often I like to share my tweets that are related to work. I find Twitter a very underrated repository of one's best brief ideas. And here are a few of them. Let's see, which one do I want to give you first? Okay. This first one's about learning. For 4 years now, respected colleagues and I meet every month on this website called freeconferencecall.com. It's a free teleconferencing call for an hour. And the structure is very simple. I simply ask who would like to take the floor. Someone shares a problem. The group asks questions and offers suggestions until the person cedes the floor. That gives them really good input on a just-in-time basis. But I mentioned this before on the show, but I haven't mentioned this. Some months, none of the members of our, and there's an average six people show up for each. I have eight people are official members, and six generally show up each month. There's always something that comes up for one or two of them. But if we have a month where, say, after 40 minutes or so, nobody in the group has got a problem that they want to share, I simply invite people to give a few-minute lecture on whatever they would like to share with the group. And that educates people. You don't have to necessarily talk about your career or whatever, but we all have things we think about. Maybe it's thinking about the 2020 election. Maybe it's thinking about money. They have an innovative idea about Bitcoin. Or maybe it's about their fear of aging or how they dealt with fear of aging. Or they've got an upcoming hospital visit or their aging parent or something more fun like, they hate standard cruises. They're just eat fests. And, they've got brainstormed some ideas about how to have an interesting kind of unconventional vacation. So the people who are in my, I call it the board of advisors, they will hold forth for a few minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and these are all people who I've hand-selected, and you can do the same for yourself. Pick, half a dozen people you think are interesting and good in a group, won't be dominating or too quiet, and or kind, and therefore won't be hurtful to the members of the group. And start a group with a half a dozen such people, and as I said, one person can either bring up a problem they're facing, or if there are no problems, that particular, that monthly hour, they can hold forth on whatever they find interesting. It's a great, definitely under the radar, again, way to learn. Now I want another one, and of course in my tweet I didn't, that tweet is limited to 280 characters, so I clearly didn't say all that, but I wanted to flesh it out for you. Another one. Not long ago, I spoke with a longtime Silicon Valley insider who says, and now I'm talking about specifically career issues, he says that the media's pushing of people to get into computers, whether by, major in computer science or go to a boot camp. He literally, this was a quote, he said, it's crazy. He said, employers are hiring coders at $5 an hour in Asia, and for the high-level work, $25. Now, I'm well aware that still, at this point, there's still plenty of jobs. Indeed, one of the fastest-growing jobs are software engineers and other computer-centric jobs. But if you are at this point, you or somebody you care about, your kid, your grandkid, your cousin, whatever, is considering a career, and you're saying, maybe I should major in computer science or computer engineering, you're going to have years before you even start, and then a 20, 30, 40, 50-year work span by the time you are even at the beginning of your career, let alone mid-career. It just seems too likely, unless you love it. I mean, if you're one of these people who just is a natural programmer and loves it, but a lot of people choose these kind of careers, whether it be software engineering or software sales or even software project management, they don't really like it. That's where the jobs are. If you're naturally really interested in that and you're naturally good at it, fine. But if you're pursuing that career because you think that's where the money is, you need to look not just this year or 3 years from now, but over the work span of your life, which, depending upon your age, could be 10 years or 50 years. So beware. That's why there is some rationale to following your passion, following what you're good at, what you're interested in, because that will sustain you even in a tough job market because you like it that much. Okay, another tweet I wrote. And this, again, is relatively fresh. Informational interviews, that is, trying to get to talk to somebody in a particular career that you're exploring, it's overrated. First of all, as people are ever busier, they're unlikely to grant you an informational interview. And even if you get one, their opinion is idiosyncratic. Today, it is better to use a Google search on the name of, say, your target career. You know, like geologist careers or environmental monitoring careers. And then, but don't forget, by the way, Google, you can search specifically for videos. Very often people are affected more by video than they are for text. So consider, you know, looking at those YouTube videos. And now, give out the phone number again, then we're going to go to the phones. If you've got a work-related problem, the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's the number here. Work with Marty Nemco and KELW, 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a retired teacher from community college. I taught English as a second language. I've also made a film, a documentary film, and done a lot of research, and I like to travel. Mm-hmm. And I retired about a year ago, and I have a lot of ideas. And I was just wondering if you have any advice for me for a retirement career.
Absolutely. So you have a lot of ideas. I think probably the smartest thing to do would be to ask you to tick off them and I'll react. But first, my curiosity gets the best of me. What was your documentary film about?
It was about my family who lived in Hungary in the 1920s and 30s, and I found footage from them and I made a film about them.
What's one thing that surprised you that you learned in the course of making that film?
I learned that I had that there were a lot of family secrets, and that I learned that I made all kinds of contacts with people after the film was done that I never would have gotten to meet if I hadn't made the film.
Okay, so as your retirement, do you want to run by the various ideas you had, or would you like to hear one from me?
I was sort of interested in, I'm not on the financial side so much, but I'm was interested in the retirement coach idea and some of the aspects of the dating coach, especially the aspects about filming people and that kind of thing. But I'm open to some of your ideas.
Okay. So let me throw one out at you and just tell me as a starting place for our discussion, and you tell me what you like and don't like about it. Clearly family matters to you in relationships, because both in terms of the film and in terms of what you say was intriguing about the various careers I threw out there. You didn't show any interest in being an electrotechnology diagnostic person. You were
right.
Focused on the people kind of stuff.
Exactly.
What if I said that you need to take that film, which apparently was, was a very core, one of your life's central accomplishments, and build on it? You were an ESL teacher. Had you ever thought about not making another film about your family? You probably exhausted that. But using your ESL skills to go to some other country to profile some other family or individual for, not necessarily for money, but as a wonderful retirement activity, and who knows, you'll make a few dollars teaching ESL, and who knows, maybe that film could catapult you into some kind of family doing family histories, family memoirs, whatever. Is there any interest in your doing some kind of travel like that and making a video, even a very short one?
Well, I was interested in maybe teaching people about how they could do their own videos and make their own family histories.
Okay, great. So you have the luxury in that you're in a retirement career. It's not like you're trying to make a living doing this. So what if I said, all I want you to do to make it simple is to write a one-pager that would describe, just theoretically, you're just doing this as a thought experiment, the steps you would take a person through to help him or her create this video of their family history. In other words, you know, would they start with interviewing? Would they start with identifying signature events? Would they start with equipment? Well, make a list of everything you would do in order, and it might vary with the individual. And then use that as a way of clarifying your thinking, and then query maybe a half a dozen or a dozen of the people you know in your life. One of the advantages of being older is you had a long time to meet people, starting from when you were a child to today. Query a few of the people who you think are most likely to hire you, or even not for money, collaboratively work with you on creating a family memoir, and then either individually coach them or decide that maybe you're going to run a meetup that's going to meet weekly or monthly to discuss, you know, to talk about creating a family movie or something like that.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You like that?
The meetup idea.
Okay.
Yeah, because then you can have the topic be whatever you're interested in.
Of course.
Yeah. And you could be local.
I could either quit, but what? Let's say I said that was it. I said, I want you to get out the phone. I want you to do a little writing to clarify, journaling about it, whatever, and then have an exploratory meeting, a meetup in your area about creating family legacies, whether it be a book or a video or whatever. What feels yucky or fuzzy about that?
It feels yucky or fuzzy.
Yeah, we want to make it optimize it here. I want to, you know.
I guess about how to market it.
Okay, great. So normally
setting up a meetup.
Right. So besides setting up the meetup, you can, whatever your vehicles are you going to, you could call your friends, email your friends, text your friends. You could put it on your social media if you use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever. There are websites that focus on genealogy and family histories. You could write a little, if you're a writing type person, you're a teacher, you probably can write reasonably. It doesn't have to be anything, you're not creating, you know, James Joyce, Ulysses. You could write a short little article on the art, and that's what would also crystallize the way in which you might want to teach it. Write a short article on 7 steps to creating your family memoir, which you can use to market. You can submit it to the various genealogy and similar websites, use that, and as well send that to your friends. That'll establish your credibility as well as get you clearer about how you'd want to do this training. How does that feel?
Yeah, that sounds good. I like the 7 steps to creating. I mean, something like simple.
Right. Oh, that's what people want. Everybody's overwhelmed, and it's
steps or whatever.
Right, as many as legitimately do. You know, don't pick the number in advance. It could be 3 steps. It could be 12 steps. But you know, keep it simple, because it's a luxury to do a family history, and very often it's older people who are doing a family history, and they themselves may not have the greatest energy or health. So if you can make it ultra simple, that's going to have a particular appeal. There's a mistake that most people who are trying to train others. They love their field so much, so they need to include everything but the kitchen sink, and they make it overly complex. There's a grand canyon of difference between the person whose mind is developing this course and teaching it and the consumer of the course. That's why so many college courses go so unliked. The professor just loves Shakespeare to the nth degree, and the students are taking it because it's a required course. And it's very important for the instructors to not be narcissistic. And instead of thinking about what they would like, putting themselves in the shoes of their audience and saying, what would my audience like? That is maybe the key to a good article, to good training, and frankly, to good relationships. Does that make sense? Any other questions, comments, criticisms before I let you go?
No, I think you've given me some really good ideas.
That's my job.
I really appreciate it.
And it's my pleasure to do it. Thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. And I do encourage you, you know, if you try this and it either succeeds, fails, or something in the middle, you know, listeners like to hear the progress report. So feel free to call back.
Okay, I will.
Okay, take care.
Thank you, Marty.
Bye. We've only got a minute or two, so I've got a couple more of these tweets that I wanted to talk about. I was in the middle of saying that about informational interviews are overrated because people are either so busy they're less likely to grant you one, and even if you get one, their opinion is idiosyncratic. I'm a career counselor. You talk to me about career counseling, you can get a very different impression than you might get from some talking to somebody else. It is far better to use a Google search on that, as I said, on that name of your career, and include videos, because we tend to learn more, most of us, from visuals. Now, another example of a career-related tweet. If you're a job seeker, compress your job search. I think I've given this one before, so I think I'm going to pass on doing that. Let me share with you just one that I haven't. When you're negotiating salary, and because right now I have a lot of clients, because the unemployment rate is the lowest in 50 years, I have a lot of clients who have much more leverage now, or they're either employed and renegotiating the salary, or they're job seeker, they just landed a job. They're in a much stronger position to negotiate salary. The amount of salary that you additionally negotiate is taxed at your top rate, and the employer gets nothing in return. So focus on non-cash items like a better-suited job description, the right to telecommute for a part of a week, having a training budget. Those are particularly important. Now, one more. I've got another minute or two, so I want to share it. I hold an unconventional view on lack of confidence. And that is that lack of confidence generally is justified. And its cure is not in mantras or affirmations. The cure is in finding an area or two in which you have at least the potential to be competent and devote yourself wholeheartedly to becoming so. And that's going to increase your competence legitimately. All right, I've got time for one more. America, even though it's a mixed economy, part socialist and part capitalist now, competition is still hardwired in many of us. I don't know if it's it's something that's Darwinianly surviving, survival attribute, or it's been conditioned by society. But certainly, in competition has its advantages, but it's certainly foolish to compete on the trivial. So many people compete on looks. In their sports, they're too competitive. Fancy meals, fancy cars. You know that your life is better led if you focus on more important things. That also keeps you more ethical at work and also keeps you from taking jobs that you don't feel are particularly ethical. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover, whatever your work problem, I can usually help. Plus, are we headed to the end of open workspaces? Worker advocates in the not-so-distant past were used to say, oh, yes, we got to tear down the hierarchy, tear down the walls, none of these private offices. But a heck of a lot of workers now are saying, I can't concentrate, and I'm even collaborating less. Please give us some walls. I'm going to share the pros and cons of open workspaces. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.